But first, it lasted for about 6 months, and today, a federal jury found former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick guilty of 24 counts of racketeering, bribery, and extortion. Now, you might remember Kilpatrick previously spent a year in prison for lying under oath about a sexting affair he had with his chief of staff and for violating his probation. Here we are today, and it's not going to be just a few weeks or a few months. The mayor, the former mayor, is going to be facing some serious prison time. We have with us Sarah Swick. She's been covering the case for Michigan Radio. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Lester. It's great to be here.
And Larry Dubin, he's professor of law at University of Detroit Mercy, is with us as well. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Lester.
So they deliberated, the jury that is, deliberated for 14 days before reaching a verdict, two dozen guilty counts. What exactly was the mayor doing?
Basically, the mayor, his father, Bernard Kilpatrick, and Bobby Ferguson, who is a longtime high school friend of Kwame Kilpatrick's and also a city contractor while Kilpatrick was in office, they were accused by the federal government of running what they called the Kilpatrick Enterprise, which, to put it simply, was basically they used various ways, various schemes to enrich themselves using Kilpatrick's office as mayor. And so the big charge here was a racketeering conspiracy or RICO charge on this so-called kind of overall corruption. And Kwame Kilpatrick was found guilty on that count, and Bobby Ferguson was found guilty on that count. But Bernard Kilpatrick, the jury could not reach a verdict.
Yeah, Bernard Kilpatrick being Kwame's father. Yeah, the only thing he was convicted of was tax evasion. Is that correct?
That's right. He was only found guilty of one count of the tax evasion, yes.
So, Larry, we've got racketeering, extortion, corruption, bribery, mail fraud, wire fraud, false tax income, tax evasion. How surprising are these decisions?
Well, this was, I think, a more difficult case to predict than it seems now that we know what the jury has done. It was a complicated case, three defendants, many, many counts, months of evidence. Under those circumstances, and also, I have to say, I think for the benefit of the defense going into it, a fairly diverse jury of in terms of sex, in terms of race, all of that speaks well, I think, for the way the system operates. So when you have a complicated case, that generally is going to be of some benefit to the defendant because they want to show reasonable doubt. And the more complicated the case, the more the attention of the jurors is spread around, and there's the potential for reasonable doubt to emerge. I think that was definitely a benefit for the defense. I think here, though, there were so many witnesses that even though you can always impeach government witnesses of the type that testified for having a bias, which these defense lawyers certainly did. The cumulative effect, and Sarah would be in a better position to speak to this because she was in the courtroom, but I think the cumulative effect is that whereas you can destroy some witnesses' credibility, overall, perhaps all of them cumulatively come forth with more trustworthiness than individually maybe some of them would have otherwise.
Sarah, as the verdicts were read, I'm told that former Mayor Kilpatrick seemed stunned.
He did seem stunned. He almost, you know, he was kind of looking down, you know, at it, almost holding his hands as if he was praying, and then at other times looked around just almost bewildered, you know, kind of angry. Bobby Ferguson was a bit more impassive, and Bernard Kilpatrick was, when they finally read the very last charge, the only one, the tax charge of which he was found guilty, he sort of had a look of surprise on his face. But, yeah, Kwame Kilpatrick, he seemed stunned.
So afterwards, I understand that Bobby Ferguson made some kind of statement of faith, saying that God was with him, that he still held his faith was strong. What did the former mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, have to say?
He has not said anything as of this time. He has come out. All three defendants came out of the courtroom, quickly got in the car. Bobby Ferguson did sort of make that one utterance. But other than that, they were silent. And the jurors, I mean, looking at Professor Dubin alluded to this already, but it was a very complex case. And it certainly appears both in terms of when you look at how the verdict came out in terms of which counts they reached a guilty verdict on, which counts they could not reach a verdict on, and which they found not guilty. It appears that the jury was, you know, there was a lot of concern. This is such a complex case. You know, is the jury going to be able to follow this avalanche of evidence that the prosecution presented? Are these government witnesses trustworthy? And then there were sort of also these lingering questions of perhaps race and whether that would factor at all into, you know, there being one or two jurors not wanting to convict any members of the Kilpatrick enterprise. But looking at the verdict all the way through, hearing what jurors had to say afterwards, it appeared that they were very conscientious, very thorough, and took this on very much in sort of the objective, legally minded way that one would want a jury to approach a case.
Well, I would even say that this jury, I think, was very unusual in that they asked very few questions of the judge. They weren't the type of questions that indicated one way or another how the deliberations were going. I think that there was some expectation that perhaps due to the lengthy deliberations that there would be signs that they were having difficulty reaching a verdict. They never showed that. This is a complex case. If you look at the instructions in this case alone, for 12 individuals without law degrees to understand RICO and all of the various elements of these charges, which they're required to find beyond a reasonable doubt, is a significant task. And for them to do this so methodically and end up with unanimity almost across the board is quite remarkable.
Now, minutes after the verdict, Mayor Dave Bing put out a release saying, "Glad this piece of history is behind us. Let's go ahead and write this city and keep it going the way it is." You know, we have these big corruption trials every once in a while. You think it sends out a warning to all the politicians, hey, you know, watch your P's and Q's. But then we end up with another case like this. Do you think there's a message here from this jury to other politicians in this and other states and cities about this kind of behavior?
I think so in one sense. I mean, I think the locally of interest here is that the FBI is investigating alleged corruption of Wayne County Executive Robert Ficano's administration, and a couple of people have already gone to trial and pleaded in some corruption cases related to that. So it's possible that within town here, that this could just almost, I'm not going to say this is a place setting, this is obviously a major event, but it's possible that there are more sort of corruption trials and sort of similar allegations of wrongdoing yet to emerge in court.
Professor?
Well, I think that the types of convictions, and especially using the RICO law to convict the former mayor and Bobby Ferguson, shows that prosecutors now, I think across the country, are very clear about wanting to go after public corruption. And we've seen convictions in the state of New Jersey. We saw a recent one down in New Orleans. I don't know if they're deterring other politicians, but it's certainly sending out a very clear signal that prosecutors and especially U.S. attorneys are very willing to use laws that, when public officials are found guilty, will put forth the worst type of prison sentences that are available for those crimes.
Well, we'll leave it with one point. Reporter Chris Gouts did a tweet earlier today saying, you know, the average federal prisoner makes about 40 cents an hour. Given that Kwame Kilpatrick's had some difficulty paying back the city of Detroit money he already owes them, this might exacerbate that a bit.
I think that there's no question about that. But then on the other hand,
maybe the least of his worries.
It seems questionable that he was intent on repaying that restitution that he owes in the first place.
There's an additional issue here, and I don't know how it will impact Bobby Ferguson, but the consequences of civil action, of forfeiture action on any property that can stem from a RICO conviction is something that perhaps will have a serious financial impact on his resources.
To put it succinctly, I don't know that Kwame Kilpatrick ever would have paid back the restitution money he owes to the city of Detroit, and even if he was able to, it probably wouldn't help the city a whole lot at this point anyway.
That's Sarah Swick with Michigan Radio, and we've also heard from Larry Dubin, who's professor of law at University of Detroit Mercy. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be with
you. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Michigan's economy is recovering at a faster rate than most states, and much of that growth is because the automakers are doing a lot better these days. Ford, GM, Chrysler, all seeing increased sales in North America, sometimes double-digit increases in sales. Recent reports show some slight increases in sales in China. Only European sales are lagging right now. But just how healthy is it for Michigan to remain so reliant on building cars and trucks? As Rick Haglund with Bridge Magazine recently reported, the state's economy has not diversified a lot. We're riding along with the cyclical health of the auto industry. It's booming for now, but for how long? And that's what we want to talk to Rick now. He joins us. So, Rick, how good has Michigan's recovery been? How much of that is due to the auto industry?
Well, it has been pretty good compared to other states. We had the sixth highest performance or sixth best performance in gross domestic state product in 2011. It's been a fairly slow recovery compared to past recoveries. You know, the job growth has been fairly subdued. So it's been a little bit uneven. The auto companies have been really the bright spot, which is good for Michigan because we are so dependent on the auto industry. The auto recovery has been faster than the recovery of the general economy for a number of reasons. One, interestingly enough, is that people are buying cars because they have to buy cars. According to R.L. Polk data last year, the average age of a car or truck on the road was almost 11 years, which was a record. So people's cars are wearing out, and they've got to buy new ones, and that's been good for Michigan.
Let's look at the history a little bit. When the economy went south at the beginning of the recession, Michigan was among the first and hardest hit. It's been said when the national economy gets a cold, Michigan gets pneumonia. How vulnerable are we today compared to, say, 10 years ago?
I don't think we are nearly as vulnerable. We're still, you know, quite dependent on the auto industry, which is troubling in some sense that we have not that we don't have a real diversified economy. But the difference now between a few years ago is that the auto companies are in much better overall competitive position than they were. One of the things that's happened in Michigan in the past few recessions, when the auto companies have led us into recession, the companies were quite troubled going into the recession, which made things even worse. The bankruptcies of General Motors and Chrysler in 2009, and then the financial, you know, the internal financial reorganization of Ford, have really turned those companies around. And the analysts are telling me that they can make money even in a pretty good downturn. That they can be profitable when industry sales are around 10 million units, which is a pretty deep recession. So we should be in better shape the next time we go into recession, whenever that is. You never know for sure, but it looks better now than it has in the past.
Right. There's been a lot of restructuring in the auto industry. They're a lot more productive, using a lot fewer workers. The quality's improved. They're making the vehicles more competitive against the Japanese and the Korean imports. All that could give you confidence that the Detroit 3 are stronger, but has the state as a whole learned anything about this economy, about its economy and its reliance on the auto industry?
To some degree, I think we have. I mean, I think that the economy has just sort of naturally diversified in some areas. I mean, obviously, the service economy has grown a lot, so we're less dependent on actual auto jobs than we used to be. But one of the issues, though, is that There are lots of spin-off jobs from auto and manufacturing jobs, which so a lot of the areas that we've diversified into, those are such as, you know, professional and business services, for instance, are really dependent to some degree on the auto industry. So, you know, even though we have diversified somewhat, there is a broad connection there to the auto industry that we haven't been able to break.
Right. In your article, you cited some stats that showed the difference between the spinoff jobs a manufacturing job might have compared to a service sector job. Can you outline that for us?
Sure. The estimates vary, but generally the economists say that a manufacturing job, depending on where it is, every new manufacturing job results in at least two or three and sometimes as many as seven additional jobs elsewhere. George Ericchek at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research tells me that a service job actually produces a fraction of a job, about seven-tenths of a spin-off job for every service job that's created.
We've heard a lot about diversifying the economy in Michigan into the so-called knowledge industries. What's the story here in Michigan? How are we, or are we, encouraging that?
You know, I don't think that we are to the degree that we need to. One of the things that happens in Michigan, whenever things get good, we kind of forget about why things were bad, and we focus on our traditional industries, whether it's auto. There's actually been a lot of emphasis in the Snyder administration of promoting the agriculture industry, which is, you know, hundreds of years old. One of the problems that Michigan has is that it does lag the rest of the nation in these knowledge jobs, which are in healthcare, financial services, and engineering, some other areas, although we have a lot of auto engineers. And one of the reasons for that is that we have a below-average educated workforce in the state. I think we rank 35th or 36th among the states in the percentage of adults who have four-year degrees. So there are people out there like Lou Glazer at Michigan Future who are saying the reason we can't attract more of these knowledge jobs is we just don't have enough educated workers to attract these employers.
And right, and I guess it was just recently in the Detroit News, they talked about the fact that getting an education in Michigan is really expensive, and yet the state is not giving a lot of public dollars or as many public dollars to its public universities as it has. In fact, highest tuition rates, lowest contribution from the state compared to other states.
Yes, that's very much been a problem. I mean, we like many other states, have disinvested in higher education, although it's been more so in Michigan. And I think to some degree we're paying a price for that.
So what's the bottom line here? Detroit and the Michigan economy were built by, in large part, by Ford, GM, and Chrysler. Is that continued reliance a good thing, a bad thing? What are the experts saying?
Well, I think there's mixed feelings. You know, George Ericchek in my story for Bridge was telling me that this is a great industry that many other states would really like to have, and obviously some in the South have been trying to steal it from us for years. It still pays high wages, even though there are lower starting wages in the factories and fewer factory jobs, but it has such a big wealth effect. And as George Ericchek pointed out to me, they make a product that probably is not going to go away or change greatly. People will still buy automobiles. They'll still have four wheels. They'll have some kind of an engine, whether it's gasoline or electronic. It's a product that is not going to go away and is still going to be in demand for quite some time. So from that aspect, it's a good industry to have. The other thing, the downside, I guess, is that It's an industry that has shrunk greatly over the years in Michigan. It's become extremely productive through automation and robots and what have you. It's, you know, replaced thousands and thousands of factory jobs. It's not going to be a huge creator of new growth in the future. So that's, you know, there's good and bad to it.
All right. Rick Haglund writes for Bridge Magazine, put out by the Center for Michigan. Rick, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Storytelling is as old as human understanding. Before there were news reporters or historians or poets or the written word, there were storytellers. There were the people who carried the knowledge of the people in their history. It's no wonder that a good storyteller still captures us and tells us about things that explain some of the larger issues and lessons of life in a way that we can understand. Listening to stories is in our genes. The University of Michigan is presenting a series called Understanding Race, and tomorrow night at the Michigan Theater, one of those storytellers will be doing what he does best. Joining us now, LaRon Williams. Welcome to Stateside. I think too often we think of storytellers as those nice little people who visit the local library and tell the stories to kids, and you do some of that, but tomorrow night you've got a story for adults.
Yeah, most people, the common perception is when they hear the term storyteller, they think of it as a children's activity. And so it requires some work. It's a little bit of an uphill struggle to get people to realize that it even can be something for adults. You know, people used to sit on the front porch and they would share adventures and talk about things that had happened. So kind of maybe even since the advent of television has storytelling kind of gotten relegated to the role of a child's thing.
But, right. Yeah, that's very true. The TV has really kind of skewed that. Although I think that you'd agree that there are some comedians out there, for example, who are great storytellers, and they just give it in snippets with a punchline. Not every story has a punchline.
Right.
So tell me something about your story, Elm Park, 1955.
Yeah, it's a story about racial dynamics, really. It's based on true events from my life, all of which were, let's just say, at least somewhat, they carried a lot of emotion. I'm trying to avoid using the word traumatic, radio listeners, but let's call them traumatic events. So my thoughts as a child were, of course, unformulated, but the impact of those events stayed with me and resonated. And as an adult, I was faced with a choice about what to do with that information. How can I take it and turn it into something constructive? So I created a story based on the trauma, but also I wanted it to be an explicatory piece. So it isn't simply about one person's bad break or some horrible things that happened to me in life. It's also an explicatory story about the dynamics of race in my community at particular points in time. It starts out in 1955, and that's why it has the title. And the area in Flint where I grew up is called Elm Park. So that's the title. But it also covers other time periods as well.
You talked about being traumatized. How did that express itself, and how did it affect you?
Actually, I can give you a particular with that. One of the incidents in the story happened when I was 4 years old, 1955, when I was in a local barbershop, probably the most popular barbershop on the south side of Flint. And I happened to see the picture of Emmett Till that was in Jet magazine that year. And I don't know if you've ever had a chance to see that image, but imagine a four-year-old looking at something so grotesque and knowing that it was a human being. So and also knowing that this was an African-American boy like I was. And particularly in the context of that year, we learn about Emmett Till's death, his murder, but there were several lynchings that happened during 1955. And in fact, one just a week before Till was killed, where there was an African-American man who was shot in the back in public on the lawn of the courthouse with several witnesses, dozens of witnesses, and was never the murderers were never prosecuted for that crime.
Yeah. So there was an existence. Nobody saw.
Yeah. Everybody saw, but nobody saw. Yeah. So there was an existing milieu that even at age four, I already knew about. I knew a lot about. So when I saw that picture, the trauma was that I became him.
Right.
I became this boy, this grotesque looking, I'll just say creature, that I saw in this magazine. So much of the story flows out of my recognition of my vulnerability being like Emmett Till. And then there are other things that build on that too.
Is this storytelling a way for you to deal with all the leftover feelings from that young boy in 1955?
I suppose some of that is in there, but my strongest feeling about that is no, it's not really, because I think of my storytelling as a profession, and even if I want to share those traumatic events, I have to get them to a point where I'm not using them as therapy in front of an audience, which it's a difficult balance sometimes. I have stories that I haven't told. I've conceptualized them for years, but I haven't told them because the emotional pain is still so strong. So I have to be over it enough that I'm not relying on an audience situation to take care of me in the middle of it. I'm not relying on an audience to take it anywhere. It's for me, this is a story. And as I said earlier, it's an explicatory story. The value of the story lies in that it offers social explanations for what happened, even for why Emmett Till was killed, even for the things that come later. It offers explanations for those things. So I'm not asking people to come there and simply open up their hearts. I'm asking people to come and listen to a factual account that just happens to be personal as well.
Now, storytellers have a knack for telling engaging stories. We, you know, understand the characters. We get involved in the adventures. But the really good ones make us think about our own lives. So at the end of your story, what do you hope your audience carries away from the experience?
Yeah, actually just that. I hope that I've taken concepts, ideas, events that may be perceived in the abstract, or they're large social events. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in our discussion about, particularly about race or racial dynamics, it's easy to leave things on that level, on the abstract level. Either we very deeply feel them, but don't think about them, don't have a way to bring understanding to those things, or we understand them, but don't necessarily feel them. In other words, academicians have done a great deal of work in delving into and explaining racial dynamics through history, but in many cases, it remains an academic exercise. But at the same time, of course, race infects every area of our lives, and it is very much our lived experience. So we have strong feelings about it, don't necessarily study it. And that schism seems to be true with stories as well. So what I wanted to do was to take the explanation part and bring it home, to make it personal, to cement it to real events in my life.
LaRon Williams is going to be appearing at Michigan Theater tomorrow night as part of the University of Michigan's Understanding Race Project. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. Lawmakers in Lansing are beginning their months-long task of approving a budget for next fiscal year. Almost as soon as Governor Snyder released his proposed budget, legislators on both sides of the aisle started questioning a plan to add money to the state's savings account. As Michigan Public Radio's Jake Neer reports, a lot of people have a lot of other ideas on how to use that money.
So picture this. You've got a little bit of extra cash, and you're thinking about putting it in your savings account. You've got some debt, some bills to pay, things you've needed to take care of for a while. Money's been tight. Let's also assume that you have a family with other opinions about how to use that money. So this is sort of what's happening in Lansing right now. It's not a perfect comparison. Government's not a family, and you're not going to be voted out of your family for your ideas about what to do with the cash. But the point is, saving money isn't easy or fun for anyone. That brings us to Michigan's Budget Stabilization Fund, or as it's more commonly known, the Rainy Day Fund. It's the state's savings account. Governor Rick Snyder wants to add $75 million to it this year. There's about $500 million in the fund right now. When Snyder took office, that account was almost empty. We're talking around $2 million. According to economists, that's like having $5 in your savings account. The governor's been trying to build up the fund. He says it would help improve the state's credit rating, Michigan would get better interest rates, and there'd be money on hand to protect against huge budget cuts in case of an emergency. The state can add to the account or take money out of it for pretty much any reason if the governor and lawmakers can agree on it. And that's where things get tricky.
It's been raining in our schools ever since this governor took office, and we have a responsibility to put that money in our schools now.
That's Democratic State Representative Brandon Dillon. He and many other Democrats say the money should be put into education. Some of the more conservative Republicans in the legislature, like Tom McMillan, have a different idea.
I mean, if we got extra money sitting around, I'd prefer to pull up, you know, a coming tax cut 3 months earlier or 6 months earlier and get it out.
McMillan says government has a responsibility to return money it doesn't spend on programs to taxpayers.
It's a matter of whether the money should be sitting in a bank or sitting in our citizens' pockets.
And then there's another plan backed by Republicans like State Senator Jeff Hansen.
We need to transfer funds from the Budget Stabilization Fund into a dredging grants program.
With Great Lakes water levels at an all-time low, Hansen says the state shipping industry faces an emergency. He says the state needs $30 million to dredge harbors so ships can get in and out. His plan would take most or all of that money from the rainy day fund. But Governor Snyder's budget chief, John Nixon, says that money should not come out of the state's savings.
A lot of these issues that are being talked about, while they're valid to bring up, we feel that there's really an opportunity to address some of those other in other areas in the budget, and that we would really should be protecting that rainy day fund for real structurally unsustainable situations.
Mitch Bean is an economist and former director of the nonpartisan State House Fiscal Agency. He says it's typically a challenge for governors to keep or add dollars to the rainy day fund.
When you get a pot of money and there's honestly a bunch of politicians, everybody and her brother thinks there's these wonderful things it just absolutely has to be spent for.
Bean points to the last year and a half of Governor John Engler's administration in the early 2000s. He says a relatively light recession forced the state to spend over $3 billion in surpluses in 18 months. Now remember, with Governor Snyder's budget proposal, the rainy day fund would be worth less than $700 million. Bean says that won't go far at all if there's a budget crisis.
As we've seen, you know, you can blow through $1 billion in no time, you know, and sometimes, and we've cut a lot of services already. And next go around, if we got to cut $1 billion, it's going to be even harder.
And Bean says a lot could be riding on how politicians in Washington handle the possibility of sequestration. Michigan could lose a lot of money if across the board spending cuts become a reality. Bean and John Nixon say that's the sort of fiscal crisis that would justify raiding the state's piggy bank. For the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Jake Neer in Lansing.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. It's estimated that 78% of Michigan residents believe there are legal protections barring discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Actually, that's not true. The Michigan Elliott Larson civil rights law does not protect them. You can be fired for being gay. You could be denied housing. Hotels and restaurants can refuse patrons they think might be gay or lesbian. Those who are against granting LGBT people legal protections are worried that passing non-discrimination laws might lead to accepting marriage for lesbian and gays. Where state Supreme Courts have overturned laws that banned gay marriage, they cited their own civil protection laws protecting the rights of LGBT people. Gary Glenn is with the group American Family Association Michigan. He's also co-author of the Michigan Constitutional Amendment defining marriage as between one man and one woman and banning recognition of similar unions among same-sex couples.
So the sexual orientation policies themselves have been proven to be a threat to the institution of marriage, as cited by three state Supreme Court decisions across the country, and they threaten to penalize and discriminate against both individuals and businesses and churches and community groups like Catholic Charities, Boy Scouts, and Salvation Army simply because they don't advocate for the homosexual lifestyle.
But at the end of this month, the U.S. Supreme Court will be looking at two cases that might decide many of the issues of discrimination against LGBT people. Joining us now is Jay Kaplan with the American Civil Liberties Union. Jay, let's start with these two cases. First, the Supreme Court will be looking at California's Proposition 8. What's that about?
Yes, that's about a ballot initiative that was passed by voters in 2008, which actually took away the right of same-sex couples to get married. There was a six-month period in California where same-sex couples could get married as a result of a state Supreme Court decision. And then as a result of this voter referendum, that right was taken away.
And that's one of these cases that Gary Glenn is talking about where the state Supreme Court came in and said, hey, look, we've got these protections for LGBT people. We say we're not going to discriminate against them, and yet here we are with this proposition that does exactly that.
Well, I don't think that's such a bad thing. And there are ways in terms to find a right to marry, not only in the fact that you have non-discrimination laws, but also in our Constitution. We have an equal protection clause that says that people are to be treated fairly under the law. And any time you deny people a fundamental constitutional right, which, by the way, the United States Supreme Court has said that the right to marry is a fundamental right, it implicates the Constitution. But I would also, you know, in response to what Mr. Glenn said, we have more than 20 states across the country that have civil rights protections for LGBT people against discrimination. And at this point in time, we have 9 states plus the District of Columbia that allow same-sex couples to get married. So, you know, we're seeing a great deal of progress on marriage equality, but passing the civil rights laws don't automatically, at this point in time, bring the right to marriage equality. And if the United States Supreme Court decides that there is a right for same-sex couples to get married, states that don't have civil rights protections, like in Michigan, will have to allow same-sex couples to get married.
Now, the second case is out of New York, and it centers on a woman named Edie Windsor. I know the National ACLU is involved in this case as well. What's that one about?
Yes, that's actually, it is the National ACLU's case. That involves a challenge to the federal law called the Defense of Marriage Act. Section 3 of that law says that even for same-sex couples who legally get married in states that permit that or jurisdictions that permit that, that the federal government will not recognize their marriage for purposes of any benefits or programs. So the situation with Edie Windsor, she and her deceased spouse, Thea Sparrer, were married in Canada. Thea passed away, and Edie inherited her estate. And normally, the federal government for married couples does not charge them with federal estate inheritance taxes. But in Edie's situation, since they would not recognize that marriage, she was forced to pay $350,000 in inheritance taxes. So she is challenging the constitutionality of such a law.
Now, this is not uncommon. There are a lot of gay couples who may have been married someplace else, a state that recognizes it or a country that recognizes it, and yet the federal government does not recognize it for tax purposes. If you put both your names on a house, for example, you'll have to have the taxes reassessed and everything else just as if you had sold it. There are a lot of tax advantages to marriage that lesbian and gay couples cannot take advantage of because their marriage is not recognized.
Absolutely. And in addition to tax considerations, it also impacts Social Security, where legally married couples are allowed to select their spousal share of their spouse if their spouse has been working and would be receiving a larger Social Security benefit for immigration purposes, for federal pensions. All of those things are being deprived. And the irony is here you have people who are legally married, and usually we allow in terms the issue of marriage to be in the purview of states, and yet here the federal government is interfering in terms of that they are treating these legally married couples as strangers in the eyes of federal law and federal policy.
How is it that the U.S. Supreme Court decided to take up these two cases almost together? I mean, two subsequent days.
Well, I think we're seeing tremendous progress made in the area of marriage equality. Just in the last 5 years, we're seeing more states, either through a voter referendum or through the legislature or through court decisions, finding that, you know, deciding that same-sex couples do deserve that same fundamental right to get married. And we're also seeing in the lower federal courts challenges being brought, successful challenges. Certainly the Prop 8 case, you know, a successful challenge to this voter referendum, which took away that fundamental right to marry. And in terms of the Defense of Marriage Act, every federal court has consistently struck down the Defense of Marriage Act, the constitutionality, and so it was a likelihood that it was going to make it to the United States Supreme Court, and I think the court is aware of this progress that's being made on this issue and their need to get involved in this issue and to decide some very crucial things regarding the issue of marriage equality.
Now, I'm going to ask you in a moment to speculate on the many different ways the Supreme Court could view this, but let's start with the makeup of the court. It's a conservative majority. Will that have an impact on a case like this or the cases like these?
There's 9 members on the United States Supreme Court. I think we could easily characterize 4 of those justices as being progressive, 4 of these justices being reliably conservative, and Justice Kennedy, Anthony Kennedy, who in the past has written, actually authored the favorable decisions on behalf of LGBT people in the case of Romer versus Evans and Lawrence versus Texas. So the thought is he might be the deciding factor in this issue. He is normally reliably conservative on many other issues.
Now, your attorneys know what those cases are. Could you tell me what those 2 cases are?
Absolutely. The Romer versus Evans was a 1996 decision which held unconstitutional a law in Colorado that said Colorado can never pass any laws that would protect gay people against discrimination. And Lawrence versus Texas was a 2003 decision where Texas criminalized same-sex sodomy, did not criminalize opposite-sex sodomy. These laws, these same-sex sodomy laws, frequently were used by states to justify discrimination against gay people. And it was struck down as unconstitutional and a violation of people's privacy.
Let's start with California Prop 8 again. How might the court view this case?
The court could view it in several ways. They could, first of all, there might be an issue of standing, whether or not the people who are defending Prop 8 have standing to bring this case. And that's an important issue because the state of California refused to defend Prop 8. And if they decide they don't have standing, then the lower court decision would hold, and then Californians would have, same-sex couples would have the right to get married. They could decide it narrowly, like the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which was the second level of federal courts, where they looked at the unique circumstances of California, where you had this right to marry and it was taken away, and they could strike that down as unconstitutional. And then once again, same-sex couples in California would have the right to marry. They could decide it the way the Obama administration is encouraging the court to do. They could say, let's look at states that provide some of the same rights of a state marriage, but won't allow people to get married. And there's about 8 states. And then as a result, there would be 8 more states that permit marriage equality. Or they could decide to make this an issue about marriage equality in general. And they could either hold that states have a right to deny gay couples the right to get married, to pass initiatives, or they could hold that state constitutional amendments that deny the right to marry are unconstitutional. And in that circumstance, that would have an impact on all states, including Michigan.
Now, we saw something interesting happen last week where a lesbian couple who each have adopted kids wanted to be able to make sure that the kids' future was more secure and they each had parental rights. That was taken to a federal court. The federal judge decided last week, you know, I'm not going to decide on this until the U.S. Supreme Court makes some kind of statement. Were you surprised by that?
I wasn't surprised, and I understand where the judge is coming from, because what the Supreme Court will be deciding is not only these issues of marriage equality, but also, and this is kind of legal technical terms, but the level of scrutiny, constitutional scrutiny, that is applied to discriminatory actions or policies against gay people. In the past, courts have applied the lowest level of scrutiny. In other words, a level of scrutiny that is very deferential to the state and to government, what's called a rational basis. However, in these cases, what the Obama administration, in their legal briefs that they have filed, are urging is a higher level of constitutional scrutiny. In other words, makes it harder for a state to justify when you deny a right to LGBT people. And that's a very important thing that the court's going to decide, because it might make some of these marriage prohibitions less likely to withstand a constitutional challenge. So I can clearly understand, since the plaintiffs have brought a marriage equality claim, they amended their complaint to challenge Michigan's constitutional amendment, why the judge would prefer to wait for some constitutional guidance from the court.
And finally, the E.D. Windsor case, the case out of New York, what are the different ways the Supreme Court could look at that?
Well, there's also going to be an issue of standing, too, because the federal government is refusing to defend the Defense of Marriage Act. So who is defending it? There's a House committee for the Republican Majority Party hired outside counsel. So they have to decide that issue. Did they have standing to appeal this decision? And if not, the lower court decision would stand, and it would strike down the Defense of Marriage Act for the First Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers some East Coast states. But it wouldn't render a decision, you know, final decision on the Defense of Marriage Act. Or they could decide there is standing and decide the constitutionality of DOMA, and they could strike that down. And I personally think there's probably a good likelihood that the court is ready to render the Defense of Marriage Act, that section, unconstitutional.
All right. Jay Kaplan is with the American Civil Liberties Union. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Lester.